Good morning. In the 8th century BC, in the middle years from about 80s through to 40s, Israel and Judah, they're separate, had a long period of stability. King Jeroboam II in the north and Uzziah or Azariah in Judah. And they were getting on quite well together, and it was a time of agricultural expansion and trade, so a wealthy time that they'd never really experienced before. Isaiah's prophetic ministry began in the last years of Uzziah's reign. Now, Uzziah was king, but he had a leprosy is the wrong name to give it, but it was certainly a virulent skin disorder that meant he couldn't really appear in public. So his son Jotham was the regent for quite a few years. And that's the period when Isaiah begins his ministry, and as we saw yesterday, those early chapters, the focus is on justice. With wealth growing and greed growing, and those in leadership positions, the gap between the rich and the poor, which was not traditionally there, was growing as well. And you already have heard what Isaiah has said about that. That will continue now in chapter 5. And then chapter 6 takes quite a shift, because that's when a special mission was given to Isaiah, a vision in the temple, and then you'll see a shift. So let's look now at chapter 5. Chapter 5 functions as a prologue to chapters 6 to 12. It begins with an accusation sung by a friend, and the friend is Isaiah, of someone who is a cheated lover. That's Yahweh. Following an ancient literary convention, the vineyard is used as a metaphor for the female body. Here's some examples from the Song of Songs of that use of language. Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom, says the author of the song. And again, awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, that its fragrance may be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. And again, my vineyard, my very own, is for myself, says the songwriter. So the owner of the vineyard is a dear friend, a yadid, of the singer. The owner's beloved is Israel, his vineyard. Already you see a little bit of difficulty here. The word Israel is used traditionally. It was used from outside. The first mention is in an Egyptian writing in the 13th century BC. These were the people in the highlands of Canaan, and they were called Israel. So it's pretty vague and pretty inclusive. For the most part, Judah was, of course, right down the south, and it was generally on its own. For two generations only, King David captured Jerusalem in the year 1000 BC, roughly, and he made it his capital, and he was militarily strong enough and attractive enough to bring the northern part in, and Judah became the key of the whole thing. It lasted during David's reign. It started to dwindle under Solomon, and when Solomon died, it fell apart. So we're back to the normal thing, where Israel is actually the northern tribes, excluding Judah. Well, here, the owner's beloved is Israel. That's meant to be all-inclusive, the people that God owns, God's chosen people. Let's begin. Chapter 5. Let me sing, says Isaiah, the poet, for my dear friend, my love song concerning his vineyard. Brackets, Israel. My dear friend had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it, he cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded bitter grapes, sour grapes, wild grapes. The adjective can have all those meanings, but you know what it means anyhow. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem, people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard than I have done? When I expected it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I'll tell you what I'll do to my vineyard. I'll remove its hedge. It shall be devoured. I'll break down its wall. It shall not be pruned or hoed. It shall be overgrown with briars and thorns. I'll also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are his pleasant planting. He expected justice, but saw a, this is my translation, I've got reasons for it, but anyhow, a cover-up. The word justice, I've actually written the Hebrew there for you to look at. That's all you need to do. If you know Hebrew, that's fine. Mishpat. So if you listen, I expected mishpat, but I got Mispach. It looks very similar except the last consonant. I expected Mishpat, but I got Mispach. He's the poet at work. A cover-up. I expected righteousness. Tzedakah. But I heard a cry of distress. Tzedakah. Tzedakah, tzedakah. Looks the same, almost. Sounds the same. But they may have, I mean, it's a real poet we're dealing with here. They're extraordinarily different. They look, everything looks right. As we'll see, the cult looks right. The system looks right. But actually it's rotten. The grapes are not edible. They're wild, bitter grapes. The fruit is not there of the vineyard. Verses 8 to 25 of Isaiah, I won't read all this, I can't, but I want to read you this from the commentary by Hans Wildberg on this text. And he writes, and it takes up two slides, but this is how he looks at it. The broad range of Isaiah's interests are mirrored in the collection of woe oracles. The disastrous economic development, which led to the degradation of the weaker members of society, reduced them to the level of outcasts. It roused him, that's Isaiah, to indignation, just as did the failure of the officials who were responsible for preserving justice. He saw the frivolous nature of those who wanted to live a pleasure-filled life to the accompaniment of wine and music. He was shocked by the arrogance of the mockers and the self-conceit of the wise. He was most deeply upset that there were leaders in responsible positions who misused their abilities by changing the laws in a way which would benefit them. And he goes on, however, Israel's sins were not simply disregard for the letter of the Torah or the teachings of wisdom. They were not due to a lack of social sensitivity or to failing to recognize that there's danger inherent in the Dolce Vita. Rather, Israel's sins were rooted in its pride, which caused it to fail to see the plan and action of the Holy One of Israel and take it to heart. Isaiah, writes Wildberger, is a passionate theologian, continually speaking about the obligations Israel has towards God. He's not merely announcing the consequences of a way of life which goes against established order. He is doing that, but not only that. He's speaking about the intervention of the Holy One of Israel, who executes his function of judging with righteousness. And one of the phrases in those verses is, they have rejected the instruction of Yahweh of hosts. They have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. That's his judgment of his contemporaries. Here's some of it. Ah, you, and heavens, how relevant is this still? You who join house to house, who add field to field until there's room for no one but you, and you're left to live alone in the midst of the land. Yahweh of hosts has sworn in my hearing, says Isaiah, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and that's 30 litres, and a homer, that's how much a donkey can carry, of seed will yield a mere ephah, a tenth of what it should yield. Ah, he goes on, you who rise early in the morning in pursuit of strong drink, who linger in the evening to be inflamed by wine. It's good to see that none of you are blushing, so this is not obviously a fault you come to the retreat with. So here he is, these people living like this. The morning is a time when they had the court, anything that needed to be tried, unlike us, who spend years and years and years in the court till a judgment is made. They used to sort things out very quickly. And so in the morning, people would come, and that were in the gateway, there was space, they'd argue the point, and then the decision would be made by the elders of the tribe. So instead of this, instead of justice happening in the morning, they're pursuing luxury. The text continues, your feasts consist of lyre and harp, tambourine and flute and wine, but you do not regard the deeds of Yahweh or see the work of Yahweh's hands. He goes on to speak of the consequences of the economic injustice. Therefore, my people go into exile without knowledge. Their nobles are dying of hunger. Their multitude is parched with thirst, whether he's actually seen this yet, or speaking about the obvious consequences that would come, and they did come. It's hard to tell. My people go into exile without knowledge. Their nobles are dying of hunger. Their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol, that's the Hades, the underworld of the dead, therefore Sheol has enlarged its appetite, opened its mouth without measure. The nobility of Jerusalem and her multitude go down, her throng and all who exult in her. People are bowed down, everyone is brought low. The eyes of the haughty are humbled, but Yahweh of hosts is exalted by justice. the Holy One shows himself holy by righteousness, right wiseness. Then the lambs shall graze as in their pasture, fatlings and kids shall feed among the ruins. Ah, you who drag iniquity along with cords of falsehood, who drag sin along with cart ropes, who say, let him make haste, let him speed his agenda, that we may see it. Let God do something. He's not, so forget about it. Let him haste. Let the plans of the Holy One of Israel hasten to fulfillment now, that so that we may know it. They're laughing at Isaiah and his threats and his ideas of God. They're living the luxurious life, and that's fine. My comment: those perpetrating this injustice are cynical of anyone who speaks to them of Yahweh's agenda or Yahweh's plan. As grounds for their cynicism, they've used the fact that God doesn't punish injustice. Doesn't seem to be. They're thriving. Another element of injustice now that Isaiah attacks: are you who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, you who are wise in your own eyes, shrewd in your own sight, you who are heroes of drinking wine and valiant at mixing drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of their rights. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble, and as dry grass sinks down in the flame, so their root will become rotten, their blossom go up like dust. For they have rejected the Torah, God's will, of Yahweh of hosts. They have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Yahweh of hosts, very frequent statement in Isaiah and elsewhere. Hosts are the stars. They were all thought of as live. They didn't realize what they are. They were fire was the most refined element of earth, air, fire, and water. So fire was, these were creatures of God, an army of God. Sometimes confused with angels, sometimes not, but that's what it means. Yahweh with all this power, and they're despising Yahweh to their own detriment. Then he speaks of Yahweh's anger. Therefore, the anger of Yahweh was kindled against his people. He stretched out his hand against them and struck them. The mountains quaked. Their corpses were like refuse in the streets. For all this, his anger has not turned away. His hand is stretched out still. And here's my comment for what it's worth. And I've touched on this earlier, of course, but here it seems relevant. Isaiah and his contemporaries assumed that God controlled everything that happened. Disasters, such as the growing threat from Assyria, was seen as God's punishment. Since God is just, this must be the result of sin. Isaiah didn't have the privilege of seeing God as God is revealed by Jesus. Neither he nor those who treasured his oracles realized how faulty and in the final analysis, dangerous their concept of God was. God is almost always going to be on the side of the powerful, of the victorious. That's dangerous. Their aim was a noble one, to warn their readers to be attentive to God's will, and what a beautiful thing that is, and not to repeat the sins of the past. But there is this assumption in their minds that comes out in the text. You may see that differently, that's how I see it. Now the Assyrian threat. Isaiah, he will raise an ensign for the nation far away and summon a people at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly, speedily. None of them is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a loincloth is loose, not a sandal thong broken. Their arrows are sharp, their bows bent. Their horses' hooves seem like flint, and their wheels like the whirlwind. Their roaring is like a lion, like young lions they roar. They growl and seize their prey. They carry it off, and no one can rescue. They will roar over it on that day like the roaring of the sea. And if one look at the land, to the land, only darkness and distress, and light grows dark with clouds. The Assyrian invasion is on the way. Syria has already fallen. It won't be long before Israel falls, and then, of course, Judah. So there's the map again, just so that you can locate it. Assyria is Iraq. Syria is, of course, west, and then down to Egypt, and they have to go through Palestine. Chapter 6 now, a crucial chapter in this material. In the year of King Uzziah's death, well, most probably that's 734 BC. So the end of a long reign. And in fact, his son Jotham died the same year. And a very young king, 8 or something, I've just forgotten now, ascended the throne or had to be looked after till he could do it himself at 18 or 20. So, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw Yahweh. He had a vision, spiritual experience. I saw Yahweh seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs, they're serpent, heavenly serpents, flying serpents, as understood, imagined by them. Seraphs were in attendance above him, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings they covered their faces, with 2 they covered their body, and with 2 they hovered. And they were calling to one another, and you know this, of course, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh Sabaoth, Yahweh Almighty, Yahweh of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, I'm lost. I'm a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts. Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. And the seraph touched my mouth and said, now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed, your sin is blotted out. Now he's been purified, his words will come only now, not from his youth and anger at what was going on, but they'll come surely, purely from God. Whom shall I send? The Lord was saying. Who will go for us? The plural. We're not talking about Trinity here, obviously. There's only one God, but the plural is the plural of dignity, etc. Elohim, the Hebrew word for God, is itself a plural. It takes in all the spiritual values that are attached by people to the deity. So, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me. And Yahweh said, go, say to this people, keep hearing without comprehending, keep seeing without understanding, stubbornly determined to resist the word. And then the Hebrew reads, make the heart of this people callous. Stop their ears, close their eyes, so that they may not see with their eyes and hear with their ears and comprehend with their minds and change their ways and be healed. God is determined to punish them, it looks like. That's one way of looking at it. The Greek version, the Septuagint, actually translates differently. So we're getting a different reading, a different way of looking at things. They have, their heart has become callous, not make them callous, Isaiah, but their heart has become callous. And the Septuagint is, of course, a Bible that's behind the New Testament. And that quote, with different nuances, of course, you'll find in Mark, Matthew, John, and Luke, and Paul. So it's constantly brought up. It's the classical text that talks about our strange callousness and inability or determination not to listen. So it's something, obviously, all of us need to attend to. We're just not listening. And for them, with their idea of God controlling, somehow or other, then they get tricked into thinking, well, God must want it that way for some purpose. God must be, just as Pharaoh's heart, in the book of Genesis, God says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Well, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, so God must have done it for some reason. And they go, their theology develops from there. My comment, the failure of Isaiah's mission posed a problem. If Yahweh sent Isaiah on a mission, how could the mission fail? For people who understand God is controlling whatever happens in the world, there's plenty of that in Isaiah, this must mean that God willed it to fail. And since the fault was not Isaiah, it must have been the hardness of heart of those to whom Isaiah was sent. Furthermore, such is the logic of the argument, if their heart is hardened, God must have willed things this way for God's own mysterious purposes. And I make the same parallel with Pharaoh. In this case, as the previous chapters have made clear, God's purpose is understood as being to get Assyria involved, to punish Judah for the injustice that pervades the lives of the rich and powerful, we've heard a lot about that, as a way of bringing them to change their ways. It's punishment with a view to repentance. So against Isaiah's advice, the leaders of Judah call on Assyria. This will lead in 701 to the terrible devastation and exile. And I read now from Isaiah chapter 6 again. I said, how long, O Lord? And he said, until cities lie waste without inhabitant. This is now we're in the year 701, and that's exactly what it was like. until cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate. Until Yahweh sends everyone far away. And vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land. Even if a tenth part remain in it, it will revert to pasture, says Isaiah, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains standing when it's felled. The holy seed is the stump. It's going to grow again from there. So now, for the rest of this morning, I'm going to introduce you to a very special three chapters that are historically absolutely located. We can know when they were written and what they're referring to. So let me introduce you to chapters 7 to 9 of the Isaiah scroll. The reign of King Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria was a period of Assyrian expansion. At first, King Rezin of Syria, Aram, Syria, had no choice but to submit to Assyria as a vassal state. Excuse me. However, he took the opportunity of Assyria's concentration on its eastern borders with Urartu and Media to break away, Syria did, and to organize an anti-Assyrian alliance, which King Pekah of Israel joined in. So the northern kingdom and Syria have combined against Assyria in Assyria's distraction in the east. In 734, the Assyrian army, 734, that's the death of Uzziah and Jotham and the little boy king who's Ahaz. In 734, the Assyrian army made a victorious sweep all along the Mediterranean coastline, conquering Philistine cities. That was easy, going down the coastline to get to Egypt, of course, and to control the trade. Conquering the Philistine cities and reaching to the borders of Egypt. Syria and Israel were now vulnerable from east and west. And King Rezin of Syria and King Pekah of Israel brought pressure to bear on Jotham, the king of Judah, who was to die anyhow, to join the alliance. And when Jotham died the same year and was succeeded by his young son Ahaz, Syria and Israel decided to invade Judah in order to depose Ahaz and put in a puppet regime. And to do that, they besieged the city of Jerusalem. This was the situation that provoked Isaiah's intervention. His message was straightforward. It was Yahweh's will that Judah remain neutral and put its trust in God, neither joining the anti-Assyrian alliance nor inviting Assyria's protection against Israel and Syria. Not joining Syria and Israel was excellent advice in every way. But then Ahaz and his advisers showed no signs of doing that in any case. In fact, the siege had to be lifted because in 733 to 732, Assyria attacked and conquered Syria and took Dor, Galilee and Gilead from Israel. Israel saved itself by a coup which replaced Pekah with Hoshea, who favoured accommodation with Assyria. It would have been suicidal for Judah to align itself with the ill-fated alliance to the north. But the other half of Isaiah's advice, that Ahaz, his advisers, chose to ignore. He decided to put his trust in Assyria, and to submit to the overlordship of Assyria, which involved paying tribute, and of course all the farmers are going to hate that, going to reduce them to poverty, and opening Judah to Assyrian imperialistic influence. Okay, it's against that background that we now read these words of Isaiah. In the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and King Pekah, son of Ramaliah of Israel, went up to attack Jerusalem, but could not mount an attack against it. And when the house of David heard that Aram had allied itself with Ephraim, Ephraim is the mountain, it's Samaria, it's the biggest tribe in the north, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of a forest shake before the wind. Then Yahweh said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shir-Yahub, which means a remnant will return the name, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway of the fuller's field, and say to him, say to the king, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint because of these two smouldering stumps of firebrands, because the fierce anger of Rezin at Aram and the son of Ramaliah. Because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Ramaliah has plotted evil against you, saying, let's go up against Judah and cut off Jerusalem and conquer it for ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king of it, putting their puppet ruler. And then, again, I've got the Hebrew a bit for you just to show you. I can't do it all the time, of course. We're dealing with poetry here. If you do not stand firm in faith, you shall not stand at all. Your whole of Judah depends on its faith in God. And if you lose that, you lose everything. The sound of the Hebrew is Im lo ta'aminu ki lo te'amenu. I've got the Hebrew there going from right to left just to show it to you. So, Im lo ta'aminu, if you don't understand by faith, ki lo te'amenu, you won't stand at all. And Yahweh spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign of Yahweh your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz says, I will not ask. I will not put Yahweh to the test. Sounds good. Yahweh himself will give you a sign, says the prophet. And you know this text, of course. Look, the young woman, Aoma, it just means a young woman who's able to bear children, and marry and have children. The young woman, pregnant and carrying a son, will name him Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey, and by the time he knows enough to reject what is wrong and choose the good, for behold, the child knows enough to reject what is wrong and choose the good, the land of the two kings whom you dread will be deserted. So it'll only be a few years till the northern, they're gone. So don't join them. The young woman, pregnant and carrying a son, will name him Emmanuel. In the Septuagint version of that Hebrew text, they use the word parthenos, virgin. It's not in the Hebrew, but it is in the Greek. And you know how in the New Testament, they go back to this text to talk about the Virgin Mary and her son Emmanuel. The book of Matthew does that. It's possible, I think likely, that Isaiah is referring to King Ahaz's young wife. If that's so, then the reference they're actually historically talking about is King Hezekiah, who was born in 732. God will be with us, and within a few years, Syria and Israel will be deserted. So the primary reference probably is to this pregnant woman's child who is going to be the next king. Isaiah then goes on to warn Ahaz that if he relies on Assyria instead of on Yahweh, Yahweh will summon Assyria to punish Judah. He refers back to the traumatic time that followed on the death of Solomon when the whole kingdom broke down. Judah was left isolated when the other tribes rejected the king of Judah and set up their own king in Israel. Chapter 8, another sign that it won't be long before Damascus and Israel will be devastated by Assyria. And then chapter 8 goes on, a warning to those who favoured putting their trust in Assyria, that Assyria would devastate their land. Then their only hope is to put their trust in God, in Yahweh. And here's a text from Isaiah 8, verse 11. Yahweh will become a sanctuary, a stone one strikes against for both houses of Israel. He will become a rock one stumbles over, a trap and a snare for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many among them shall stumble. They shall fall and be broken. They shall be snared and taken. Yahweh will become a stone that one strikes against and stumbles. In the New Testament, Paul to the Romans, chapter 9, as it is written, see, I am laying in Zion a stone that will make people stumble, a rock that will make them fall. He's using this text. First letter of Peter. Luke here, and then the first letter of Peter as well. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. It will crush anyone on whom it falls. They're both saying what this is saying. It's imperative that we welcome the divine, listen to the word, and put our trust in God. Isaiah 8:21, quoted by Matthew, and it's a beautiful text in the Hebrew. Often it's translated to make more sense than I've done here for you. But this is a literal, word-for-word effort to put it into the poetry that it existed in. He, doesn't say who, brackets a nameless refugee. He wanders across it, doesn't say what it is, nameless land, oppressed and hungry, starving and desperate. He curses his king and his God as he turns his face upwards. Downward to the earth he looks. Nothing but anguish, darkness, swirling oppression, confused gloom. There's no glimmer of light for an oppressed land. The humiliation of the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, their tribes up where the Lake of Galilee. There's oppression on the way of the sea, that's Duru in Assyrian, or Dor in Hebrew. It's not exactly a port, but it's a fishing village on the Mediterranean. In Transjordan, that's Galadzu in the Assyrian and Gilead, and in the Galilee of the nations, Megiddo. So it's referring to these, I've got the arrows pointing to them there on the map. Isaiah 9:2 goes on, and you'll remember this text, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light, says Matthew. Those dwelling in a land of deep darkness, light has dawned. Matthew introducing Jesus' ministry. Land of Zebulun, we just saw it. Land of Naphtali, on the road by the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. Beautiful. In the light of Isaiah's situation and the collapse of the whole area and the pain of it all and the desperation of it all, Matthew picks all that up and points to Jesus, of course, and says the light has dawned and gets us to watch him, the light of the world, in this area, exactly in this area, bringing light. Some texts. Here's John 8:12. Jesus, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And Paul in 2 Corinthians 4, it is the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to bring to light the knowledge of the glory of God on the face of Christ. The language of these texts has come from the synagogue and their prayerful reading, as hopefully we're doing now, of Isaiah. It gives them the imagery to give expression to their new experience of Jesus. Isaiah 9:3 reads, you have enlarged the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. So it's threatening words coming from Isaiah, but he never leaves us without glimmer, without hope, if we listen. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For all the boots of the tramping warriors, all the garments rolled in blood, shall be burned as fuel for the fire. Why? Because a child is born for us. Probably Hezekiah, a new hope for Judah. And he turned out to be one of the best kings they had. A child is born for us. A son is given to us. The son that was talked about in chapter 7. Of course, the New Testament will see that as fulfilled in Jesus. I conclude now with this and then a piece of music. Isaiah looks forward to the ascent of the king's son Hezekiah to the throne of Jerusalem, his birth, but his birth as king. And that happened in 715 BC. And the text reads, and you know it, a child is born to us. To us a son is given. Authority rests upon his shoulders. He is named Wonderful Counselor. When a prince ascended the throne, he was given a throne name, distinct from his own personal family name. So he's given a throne name. Well, this one has given all these names. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with just decrees and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. And Isaiah concludes, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts will do this. It's full of hope. Let's look at those titles and just unpack them slightly. Wonderful Counselor. One who shares in the power of Yahweh to work wonders, to establish plans that can lead the people to recognize Yahweh's way and discern Yahweh's will. That's the kind of leader Isaiah is hoping for in this child. Mighty God. He's filled with the numinous power of God against external enemies. So the divine power is with him against Assyria and Moab and Ammon, etc. Everlasting Father, divinely appointed protector of the fatherland, Prince of Peace. He will establish the land in security, prosperity, and political stability because of the wholesome state of mind of the people based on their obedience to God's revealed will. It's an extraordinary leap of hope of Isaiah ending this section of his oracles. So I'll conclude.